From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I was washed up, buddy, and that's a reality.
That's comedian Mark Maron on his epic failure and epic comeback with a celebrated comedy podcast, WTF. That story in just a moment. Today, markets are failing, governments are struggling, and American workers are taking a dive along with them. This hour, the right way to fail. We get one psychologist's advice on how to bounce back without fearing the fall, and remembering the mysterious Mary Boleyn who lost Henry VIII to her sister. Was she a failure? We'll find out. Also, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman on why the U.S. is failing.
The whole global curve has risen, all right? And what that means is average is over. Whatever you do, you've got to find some way to bring something extra to it, because in this hyper-connected world, average is officially over. Average work will not bring an average return.
I had been fired for the third time from a political talk radio / internet outlet. And my career as a comic was pretty dried up. I was in the middle of a divorce. I was broke. And I really just didn't feel like I had many options. I'd run out of choices. I was incredibly depressed. I was emotionally depleted. And I was going broke rather rapidly.
That's comedian and podcaster Mark Maron. You'd never know it from what you just heard, but Maron found a way to resurrect himself from the ruins of his career as a failed stand-up comic. In fact, he says comedy saved his life. After he was fired from his most recent job, Maron decided to record some conversations with the people he knew best, comedians. The interview went on to become one of the top-ranking comedy podcasts on iTunes and average 400,000 downloads a week. It's called WTF. These days, Maron's career is in high gear. His podcast is going strong, and he's back in the stand-up circuit again. Steve Paulson asked Maron if his old reputation as an angry guy with an axe to grind made it hard for other comedians to open up to him.
Well, you know, comics are a unique bunch of people. We're all sort of misfits and social outcasts and awkward and self-involved. I mean, you know, it takes a certain disposition to get into comedy. And I think that emotionally we share a lot of things. You know, some of us are angry. Some of us are depressed. Some of us are addictive personalities. Some of us are just megalomaniacal, but it's all sort of the same wheelhouse. And I think that once the podcast started going, they realized that they could have an honest conversation about who they are and what they do. And I think that was attractive to comics. And I think that despite the fact I was angry, a lot of them knew me and a lot of them understood where I was at and had some respect for me.
And we should point out, these comics are sitting down with you in your garage.
Yes.
Is there something magical about the garage?
It's starting to seem that way, isn't it, Steve?
I mean, this is not a fancy garage, is it?
Well, no. It's kind of this beat-up garage out back. It's a single-car garage. I mean, the house was built in probably 1924. And, like, I put a floor in there and all my books are out there. It's pretty cozy. It's something I've always wanted. I wanted it to become what it is, not necessarily a studio, but kind of like a, I guess they'd call it a man cave. You know, there's a magic quality to it. It's pretty cozy.
Now, the episode that really put you on the map was your conversation with Robin Williams. And this was not the usual Robin Williams that we've heard, sort of that, you know, hyperdrive manic Robin Williams. He was actually pretty laid back and real. Can you tell me about that interview?
Well, you know, he's a pretty sweet guy when you hang around. He was always oddly fairly accessible when you run into him at a comedy club or something and you sit and chat with him. If there's not too many people around, he's almost shy and very sweet. And I think that once he agreed to do it, you know, I drove up to his place up in the Bay Area. It was 11 in the morning. It was at his home. There was no one there. It was just the two of us with two microphones. And I don't think that there was anyone really to perform for. And I think he was at a point in his life where he'd had a relapse on alcohol. He'd had heart surgery. You know, he was looking at some darkness, and, you know, he'd gone through a divorce. And there was a vulnerability there that I certainly understood, and I think that he was ready to talk about, and to talk about it in a candid way.
You know, you've had all this stuff, and that, you know, there really is a certain degree of, like, it doesn't matter.
Big time.
It just doesn't matter.
That's the kind of the freedom, the ultimate freedom of letting go in a weird way. Like when you talked about all this stuff, you know, the shit that they say about you. And I know it's out there, and it used to be, it would immobilize me. And now
it would hurt your feelings.
Oh, it hurts everything. You just kind of go, well, I shouldn't perform. Then going, no, you love performing. Go out and perform. People will say good things. People will say bad things. It's the nature of the world. It's like you say, it's like Tina Fey once said, if you're ever feeling really good about yourself, there's this thing called the internet. Now, at this point in your life, going on stage, being around people you have a good time with, and seeing people like Pearl, seeing people like Overton, and hanging out with friends, and you go, oh, God, and hanging with you, even when we're at the Comedy Cellar, going upstairs and just riffing, go, that's worth it to me more than worrying about, oh, how am I doing?
And there's another kind of conversation that you sometimes have where you start out apologizing to your guest because maybe you had trouble with this person in the past, and you sort of, you know, are upfront about it. You're kind of laying it all out there.
Well, I have to do that. I don't know. A lot of times when I do that, there are a lot of people that I've had problems with in the past, a lot of people that I felt like I owed apologies for. But you have to understand that sometimes I will hold on to one meeting, you know, that happened 15 years ago that I still remember as me being a bastard of some kind. And sometimes people remember it. Sometimes they don't. But there are deeper difficulties. I mean, like with me and Louis C.K.
I was going to ask about that.
Well, that was a strained relationship for a long time. You know, I love the guy.
And you go way back to him. I mean, you both sort of started out as comics together, right?
Yeah. I've known him a long time. And I always had a pretty deep emotional connection to him, and I think he to me. And we always were able to sort of lock in when necessary and walk each other through things. But we sort of lost touch. And my envy got the best of me, and we just didn't talk to each other, and it was difficult. So when I did those interviews, that was some pretty real stuff to try to kind of navigate and renegotiate a friendship, to try to save a friendship.
You know, we had a our friendship faded away at some point, and I had time when I was writing you emails to connect with you personally.
Yeah.
And you were ignored me.
Really?
Yeah, for a long time. For, I don't know, over a year.
Really?
Longer than that, yeah. Ugh. You just wouldn't answer me. And I would write emails that said, I'm not sure why you're not writing me back, but I'm going to persist because our friendship goes back far enough.
Right,
I
remember that.
Saving.
Yeah.
You just wouldn't answer me.
What the
f***
was my problem?
At some point, I caught you on the phone and you said that you felt like when we talk, it's just about me and I don't really listen to you, that I'm very self-centered.
Right.
And I took that to heart, but I also thought, well, I felt like it was unfair.
You know, it almost sounds like some of these podcasts kind of function like therapy. You know, people getting stuff off their chest and for some reason telling it to the world, at least those people who follow you, gets rid of something out of their deep black box.
Sometimes. There have been times where people come to it with different expectations. Some people are willing to talk. Some people want to talk. But a lot of times, like I said, these are thoughtful people. The Todd Hanson episode around this type of conversation that you and I are having was really the most profound as an event. And I think a lot of times...
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, Todd Hanson was really the original head writer of The Onion for most practical purposes. He was there at the ground floor, you know, comes from up in your area.
Right.
I'd known him for years, and I'd always liked him. We didn't talk much, but, like, we were all in the same circle. And I had scheduled an interview with him in New York. I was there for a few days doing a live WTF in Brooklyn. And I said, look, let's do an interview. Let's do this. Why don't you meet me at my hotel? So Todd comes over to the hotel, and he basically says, yeah, I've been to this hotel before. And this is off mic. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I came here and I checked in and I had no intention of checking out. So off mic, I said, well, what are we going to do here? Are we going to talk about this or what do you want to do? And he goes, I don't know. I don't know. So we did the interview and we talked for an hour about The Onion, about its impact, about, you know, where it came from, where he came from. And at the end, he just said, look, maybe we have more to talk about another time, but I really appreciate, you know, whatever he said. I'm paraphrasing. So that was the end of that interview. And I just kind of held on to it. I said, look, you know, if you want to talk about this, the other thing, we can do a second part to this. And he's like, okay, I'll think about it. So I didn't put up that first interview. I just held on to it. And a few months later, you know, he said, I think I can talk about it. So I said, okay. So I met him at his apartment. And he, you know, he walked me through that day and those feelings and the repercussions of taking that action and how it affected him and others and how he felt now. And I posted those two together. Now, what we talked about, though, that you wanted to make sure that we talked about.
I just wanted to say I'm sorry to all those people. I mean,
about the selfishness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, I mean, I talked about this a little bit, that I had left this note saying, oh, you know, I'm really sorry. But that wasn't good enough, you know? It's a selfish thing to do, to take people's love and not give it back, you know? And if you abandon them, then all of the investment of love that they gave you is, you just transmute it into pain. And it's not fair to them. So, I mean, not only do I thank all of those people, but I also apologize to them. I mean, I've said this to all of them many times, and they're sick and tired of hearing it, to be honest. But I just thought it was important to say, not only thank you, but I'm sorry. And it will not happen again.
And that had a profound effect on me, on hundreds and hundreds of listeners who sent emails, who had dealt with that, those feelings themselves, or had family members that they could never understand how that family member could do that or try to do that. And it just shed a lot of light in a very intimate way on a profound, horrible human reality that is completely selfish and mysterious to people that don't have those kind of feelings.
Now, we started out by talking about where you were when you first created WTF. I mean, you know, your life was a wreck at that point, and things have totally changed. I mean, the podcast is a huge hit. You do a lot of stand-up comedy. I know you've had negotiations about a TV show. Is it fair to say that comedy has saved your life again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It saved my life in a very unusual way in that I did it. No one, you know, gave me an opportunity. No one, you know, hung any sort of expectation on me. No one said, well, we're going to run this guy up the pole and see if anyone takes. Like, it was not, I'm the top of the food chain here. You know, the pride that comes from creating something successful, really with your own hands and your own mind, and taking some risks and earning a little money from it is something I never have experienced before. And it feels, I'm very grateful for it, but it just, to feel like you've earned your money and that you've earned your success is something I never thought I would feel, you know, just by virtue of how my brain is built. But it's more than I could ever ask for, and it just blows my mind because I was washed up, buddy, and that's a reality.
Hmm. So given what you've been through over the last 5 years or so, I'm wondering if you have any advice for people, comic or not, whose life has bottomed out about how to climb out of that pit.
Well, you know, and I'm in a different position than a lot of people because of whoever I am and whatever problems I have. You know, I am two divorces into life. I have no children. The dependent issue was a lot less than a lot of other people who are having trouble and they have certain responsibilities. But I do know that you have to fight through that pride and through that sense of failure. You have to somehow manage to get past that cycle of self-criticism and self-abuse for whatever you think went wrong in your life and put it aside and try to do what's in front of you and do whatever you have to do to live your life and get back up on some sort of level ground. And I know it's hard for people right now. My brother is a great example, is having a tremendous amount of difficulty because of the market, because of jobs. He's got a large family. And I don't really know what to say to him other than it's happening to a lot of people. And we all had expectations about how our life was going to turn out or how we wanted it to turn out or what we were entitled to. But a lot of that isn't happening for a lot of people. And it's really not their fault. And you just have to adapt to what's going on right now for you and for the country and just realize that you can be disappointed. But what's important is that you're alive, you're healthy, you got people that love you and depend on you, is to not ruin all that because you think you failed. Because that's the stuff that's going to get you through this.
Comedian Marc Maron talking about how to bounce back from failure and his hit comedy podcast, WTF. Steve Paulson spoke with him. I'm Jim Fleming. Why do you think we're so afraid to fail? Did you learn anything from your most epic failure? You can connect with us online at ttbook.org. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Stanford University psychologist Carol Dweck has spent decades trying to figure out how to succeed and the right way to fail. She wrote about her findings in the book Mindset, The New Psychology of Success. Dweck says it turns out everyone fails, but not everyone fails the same way.
When my research began, I started studying how students cope with failure because I understood from the start that failure was an incredibly important part of attaining success. And what I found was that some kids really fell apart, but others really became mobilized. They woke up, they said, I love a challenge. They said things like, I was hoping this would be informative. And I knew that they had a secret that I wanted to understand.
What is it that kids know about what it means to fail that somehow we don't know?
Well, some kids know it. And so I essentially devoted my life to finding out what secret those children had. And what I learned was that they had the right mindset. They understood that their intelligence, their abilities, were things that could be developed. That's why they wanted challenge. That's why they saw that failure was part of growth. And I call this the growth mindset.
And the other one you call the fixed mindset, the idea that you either have the ability and everything will go right, or
yes,
failure is the end of everything.
Yes. And the kids who crumbled, the ones who fell apart, I learned, were the ones who had this fixed mindset. They thought intelligence was just a fixed trait, as you say, you have it or you don't, and everything tested them. Every problem we gave them, every test in school they thought was a test of how smart they were. As a result, they avoided challenge and they were not resilient in the face of failure.
I think that we've all seen this to some extent. What's still unknown to me, and I gather from your research you have a better grasp of it than I, is how the kids who get it got it.
There are different ways to get it, the growth mindset. But the most fascinating way we've studied is through the praise that teachers and parents give to their children. Some praise fosters a fixed mindset, and some praise fosters a growth mindset. What we have found is that praising your child's intelligence is bad. It backfires. It creates a fixed mindset. It makes the children not want challenging tasks they could learn from. They don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to look bad. So what do we do instead? My research shows praise the process the child engaged in. Effort, strategy, taking on hard tasks, persisting in the face of obstacles. And when we do that, the children learn a growth mindset, they enjoy difficulty, and they keep on going. We just finished a study where we found that the process praise that parents give to their children when the children are 1 to 3 years old will predict their mindset and their desire for challenge 5 years later.
So basically what you're saying, if I understand this correctly, is that we spend too much time saying great job or great result when we should be spending most of our time saying, I like the way you got to that answer.
Exactly. The self-esteem movement almost brainwashed us that we could hand our children self-esteem on a silver platter by telling them they're special, they're great, they're brilliant, they're talented, they're gifted. It doesn't work that way. Those statements make children more fragile. But telling them, I like the way you worked on that, I like the strategies you tried, I like the way you picked that hard task, you're going to learn a lot from that. Those are the things that teach children how to build and maintain their self-esteem on their own while they're growing.
Yeah. Now, this is not really anything new, is it? This is knowledge that has been around, and certainly some people have understood it, perhaps just on an innate level. You might run us through some examples. Mozart, for instance. Everybody thinks Mozart was a natural. He came out of the oven already done.
Right. I think we tend to look at our heroes, Michael Jordan, Mozart, Darwin, and think, oh, they just popped out as geniuses, and their contributions were just a natural extension of their genius. That's not true. You can hardly find anyone who made a great creative contribution without years of passionate, dedicated labor, years of it overcoming adversity and setbacks. Anyone who gets to be called a genius is usually someone who, not someone who wasn't talented, sure they were talented, but they took their talent somewhere with their passionate dedication. They pushed out of their comfort zone. It's something that psychologists call deliberate practice. Constantly pushing out of your comfort zone so you can grow. And in our interventions, in our workshops for children, we teach them that when they do that, when they push out of their comfort zone to learn something new, the neurons in their brains form new connections and they get smarter. Mm-hmm.
Some of this is just in the way you look at it. You look at Michael Jordan, for instance, and everybody laughs because he wasn't a first-round draft pick. He wasn't recruited by the college that he wanted to go to. You look at that and say, yeah, but that's not what's important. What's important is why and what he did
yes.
to cope with that.
Exactly. And everyone thinks, oh, boy, they made a big mistake not drafting him. But he wasn't Michael Jordan yet. And as you're saying, what made him Michael Jordan was the way he reacted to those setbacks and challenges by becoming ever more talented.
And there are others. You mentioned Darwin. Darwin is another example of somebody from whom very little was expected when he was a young man. But he approached life, I guess you'd say, as a series of failures which he could overcome.
Exactly. His father was very disappointed that he had such a dull lad. So that was one obstacle he had in his way. But also The Origin of Species, his epic tome, took years and years to write, was the product of hundreds, maybe more, conversations with people from all over. It was really a monumental labor.
Of course, the natural next question is this forever? Are you, by the age of three, either someone with a growth mindset or a fixed mindset? Or can we change ourselves just by thinking of ourselves differently?
Yes, that's the good news, is that at any age you can learn a new mindset. We have a program for adolescents called Brainology that teaches adolescents a growth mindset and how to apply it to their schoolwork. People have done research with business managers, middle-aged business managers, and shown that they can learn a growth mindset. And when they do, they become more open to learning, more open to feedback from their employees. They become better mentors of their employees.
So if you were talking to a parent of a young child on how to equip their kid for success, what's the first order of business? What do you say to them?
I'd say stop telling your child he or she is brilliant or talented. Then I'd say make sure they are challenged all the time and that they love challenge. They see challenge as fun, as something they'll learn from. Then I'd say teach them how to persist on tasks. Boy, that's an interesting mistake, really interesting. Where should we go now? Teach them to generate new strategies in the face of setbacks. As I said earlier, this is going to help them build and maintain self-esteem while they take on challenges and achieve.
So in some ways, we should promote failure.
Yes, but within a growth mindset.
Carol Dweck studies success and failure at Stanford University, where she teaches psychology. Her book is called Mindset, The New Psychology of Success. Humans have been getting up close and personal with failure for centuries. Take the cases of Anne and Mary Boleyn. If you're wondering who, well, think back to Tudor England. Henry VIII shocks the Western world by divorcing his old queen and crowning Anne Boleyn in her place. 5 years later, he cuts off her head. Most people remember that much. But Anne Boleyn had a sister named Mary, and Henry slept with her, too, before he moved on to Anne.
Anne. I meant to come sooner. I'm sorry I did not. I've been kept occupied.
So I hear. Amusing the king.
Only that, sister, I assure you. Despite his best efforts.
What, not yours?
How is it?
The child is strong. He gives me no rest. Like his father.
Do you feel as awful as you look? You know, in France, no woman would allow herself to get in such a state.
Why did you come, Anne, if all you desire is to torment me?
Perhaps now you know how it feels. To be deceived by your sister.
I did nothing.
You stole the king away, and then you betrayed me over Henry Percy.
If that's what you think, fine, tell yourself that.
I did, sister. Every day and every night I was in exile.
A clip from the film adaptation of The Other Boleyn Girl. History hasn't been kind to Mary Boleyn. She's usually portrayed as the failed sister, the one who couldn't catch a king. Historian Alison Weir sets the record straight in the new biography Mary Boleyn, the Mistress of Kings. She tells Anne Strangechamps that Mary had a bad reputation even before she met Henry, which was probably undeserved.
It's not the sensational sex scandal we think it was, because she was quite young when she was briefly the mistress of Francis I, and we only know of that affair through something that a papal nuncio reported over 20 years later. And he's the one who called her the great and infamous whore, and he said that the French king had said she was a great and infamous whore. And both of them were certainly exaggerating. They had good reason to them. Henry VIII was not in their good books at the time, and the Boleyns were anathema to them. So it's natural that they would embroider what they remembered of Mary.
Hmm. Well, who was Mary Boleyn, and what was it about her that made her so irresistible to two different kings?
Well, she was the eldest daughter of Sir Thomas Boleyn, the eldest sister of Anne Boleyn and their brother George. And her father's chaplain said that she was by far the more beautiful of the two sisters. But it seems that Mary didn't become Henry VIII's mistress willingly. The word used was violate, and in those days that could only mean rape or ravishment. It seems she was forced into that position.
How old would she have been?
She would have been probably in her early to mid-20s at that time, and she was married. She'd been married about 2 years.
So the fact that she was married wasn't an impediment to the king raping her?
No, I wouldn't say use the word rape. I would say being put in a position where she couldn't say no. He was the king. You didn't say no to the king unless you were her younger sister, Anne, who had more temerity and daring than most people.
Yes, well, we know how that turned out.
Yes, we do. And Mary was a lot luckier than Anne, believe me.
Well, so in terms of broad strokes, here's Mary Boleyn, who's sent off to the French court, has an affair with the king there, comes back to the English court and catches the eye of Henry VIII. What are the other sort of general shape of her life?
Well, she was Henry's mistress probably for less than 2 years. She probably bore him a child, a daughter. Her second child was probably the child of her husband. A couple of years after Henry dumped her, so to speak, he began pursuing her sister Anne passionately. And a couple of years later, in 1528, Mary lost her husband and was left in penury. And from then on, she lives a very quiet life at her father's charge at Hever Castle, her family home. And she becomes a lady-in-waiting to her sister Anne. But she's kept very much in the background because her relationship with Henry created an impediment to Henry's marriage to Anne. And therefore, Mary was a walking reminder of the illegitimacy of that marriage.
Why would her relationship with Henry have been an impediment to Henry's marrying her sister?
Because sleeping with two women made the second relationship incestuous.
Oh, whether you were married or not, just the
yeah,
fact that
whether you
slept
were married
with the sister.
Or not, it was the fact of the relationship. It created what the church called an affinity. There was a barrier to the second marriage. Now, the Pope could issue a dispensation and indeed did issue a general one, not specifically for Henry to marry Anne. But later on, those dispensations were repudiated by the Church of England. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very debatable point as to whether Henry was legally married to Anne. And in fact, that was the grounds on which the marriage was annulled when she fell in 1536.
How much do we know about, I don't know, the personalities of the people we're talking about and how they would have talked with each other, what they would have done?
We don't have any quotes from Mary. We only have a couple of letters. One's very detailed and one gives us a lot of insights into her character. But you can only infer from people's actions what they did and what they wrote. With Anne, we've got a lot, so we know quite a lot about her. With Henry, we've got an enormous amount. But Mary eludes us. It's hard to know what she was like as a person. It seems that she was jealous of her sister. And that when she'd made a very unfortunate marriage, second marriage, and was banished from court, and wrote this letter to the king's chief minister, supposedly trying to get back into favour with her sister and the king, she was actually sticking the knife in with her sister, because she wrote, "I had rather beg my bread with my husband than be the greatest queen christened."
Ooh.
Ooh, ouch, yes. She didn't get anywhere.
Well, yeah.
She never saw Anne again, and they were almost certainly not reconciled.
Well, you can imagine why she would have been jealous of Anne,
you
wouldn't
can.
You?
Many, many reasons. Anne went before her into the world of courts, although Mary should have gone first as the elder sister. Anne shone. She married the king who'd abandoned Mary. And you know, there's Mary shoved into the background.
Do we know much about how Mary reacted to Anne's imprisonment?
Not at all. Not a word. And that's tragic. This is where you're sort of tearing your hair out, because there just isn't the source material. In fact, everything about Mary is controversial. And you can't just tell her life as a story, as a narrative. It's constant debate. That's always a problem for a biographer.
That's interesting. What do you mean constant debate? What are the big questions that remain?
Oh, the big questions are, well, even where she was born, what age she was, whether she was older than Anne, what she looked like. But the big question, apart from her affairs, her royal affairs, is were her children fathered by Henry VIII? And debate rages. In fact, it's very controversial. I came to the book thinking that Henry would have acknowledged those children as he did his only known bastard son, Henry Fitzroy, and he ennobled him. Now, Mary Boleyn's two children were born within her marriage to William Carey, and there was a legal presumption that they were his children. But it was almost certain that the boy who came second was William Carey's son. But the girl, Catherine Carey, who was born first, there is some very convincing evidence that she was Henry's daughter.
Wow. So here are two.
And that was quite an exciting thing. I came right the way round to the opposite point of view. I also found out that Henry had another illegitimate daughter whom he didn't acknowledge. So you couldn't just say that if the king had had illegitimate children, he would have acknowledged them.
So what happened to Mary in the end? You said that she was banished from court for making an unsuitable marriage. How unsuitable? Yeah. Who did she marry?
She married Mr. William Stafford, plain Mr. William Stafford. He wasn't even a knight. And, of course, that counted for a lot amongst the Tudor landed classes. And he didn't have any fortune. He was no match for the Queen's sister. But what was worse, she just appeared at court pregnant. That looked scandalous in itself. And then she confessed she'd made this impulsive marriage for love. And that was regarded as akin to insanity. And yeah,
one didn't
was.
Marry. You didn't marry for love. You married for political advancement or money.
You did, or money. Yes, that's right. Or to migrate families, that kind of thing. No, I mean, it was considered scandalous. And once they'd been banished the court, they went to live abroad in Calais. And then they came back to England. He got a post at court. And her father and her grandmother died, and they left her half the Boleyn wealth. But she had to fight for it. She had to contest the crown, and that took 3 years. And she didn't get a grant of it until 4 days before her death, which is pretty tragic.
Yeah. Do you think she was happy? I mean, do you think her, you know, her life looks like a trajectory upward and then a dramatic fall, and her sister looks like she's going to take off and do much better, but then, of course, her sister has a much worse fall and loses her life. Did Mary wind up happy?
I think she did, because if you read that letter to Cromwell, which is the only clue we have about her marriage, if you read that, it's quite clear how much they loved each other, apart from that he was 12 years younger than her. And he remained a widower. He mourned her for 9 years. So I think this was a happy marriage.
Alison Weir is a historical biographer and novelist. Her latest book is called Mary Boleyn, Mistress of Kings. Anne Strainsham spoke with her. Coming up, columnist Thomas Friedman says the U.S. isn't just stumbling, it's failing on the global stage. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and Public Radio International. Thomas Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. He says that as a player on the world stage, the U.S. is in decline, failing to compete with other countries in areas like education, economics, and infrastructure. Friedman writes about the problem in the book That Used to Be Us with co-author Michael Mandelbaum. He tells Steve Paulson how the U.S. was so successful in the past.
Going back to the founding of the United States, we actually had a formula for success. And that formula had basically five pillars. First, we educated people up to and beyond whatever the level of technology was. So whether it was the cotton gin or the laptop computer, they could get the most out of it. Second, we had the best infrastructure, airports, roads, you know, canals, telecommunications. So our people could really get the most out of their talents. Third, we had the world's, over time, most open immigration policy that attracted the most energetic and talented immigrants from around the world, where they would come to Silicon Valley and places like it and start, you know, 25% of new companies every year. Fourth, we had the best rules for capital formation and investing to both incentivize risk-taking and prevent recklessness. And lastly, we had the most government-funded research to push out the boundaries of science and technology so our venture capitalists could pluck the best flowers and turn them into new companies. That was our formula for success. We didn't get here by accident. We had this great public-private partnership. But the reason we're in a dip here, I don't want to say we're not in a terminal decline, but the arrows are pointing down, is, Steve, if you look at all five of those key pillars of our formula for success, the arrow is actually pointing down on all five: on education, on infrastructure, on immigration, on rules for capital investing — how'd you like that subprime crisis? — and lastly, on government-funded research. So that's what I'm worried about. That's what we're worried about.
Of course, the great irony here is that when the Cold War ended, many people assumed that America's great enemy, last great enemy, had been vanquished. There was even talk about the end of history, as if liberal democracy had triumphed once and for all. You were saying that was myth-making.
Well, it misread what was going on. Think about, you know, back in the 80s, Steve, when people said, remember Japan? Everyone said Japan was going to steamroll us and we were going to be left behind. And went, now you say it's, you know, China. We say, no, excuse me, you don't understand. See, Japan threatened one American town and two American industries. The town was called Detroit and the industries were called consumer electronics and cars. Globalization, of which China is just one manifestation, challenges every American town and every American industry. By the way, it has enormous upsides as well. It creates opportunities for every American town and every American industry, provided we have the people, the infrastructure, the skills, and the inspiration to get the most out of it and cushion the worst. This is not your grandfather's economic crisis. This is something different.
Well, and to take one example, you were talking about the need to build up infrastructure. China has spent vast amounts of money doing just that. I mean, high-speed rails and all kinds of things. And the United States, well, given the fractious nature of our politics right now, it's hard to get anything big done.
Well, you know, when you fly from Zurich, say, Zurich, Switzerland, to JFK, you arrive at the Delta Air Terminal in JFK. Truly, it is like flying from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. And you have that feeling more and more now, not just from China but from other places as well. According to the American Society of Civil Engineers, we quote this statistic in the book, we have over a $2 trillion deficit in infrastructure. And all you have to do is travel around this country to see it. I take the train often, you know, from Washington, D.C., the Acela, our high-speed train, from Washington, D.C. to New York's Penn Station. First of all, whenever I get on the train, I have a joke with a friend of mine. My friend says whenever he gets on the train and he's making cell phone calls, he tells the person on the other end he's really calling from El Salvador. So the phone may go out several times. Oh, Juan, keep it down over there in the other seat. You know, he's too embarrassed to say he's on our high-speed train in our biggest business corridor, or, you know, in the country from Washington to New York.
Is this the liberal agenda you're pushing here? I mean, more government spending to build up all kinds of industries around the country?
Well, you know, as many of the reviewers of our book have noted, particularly conservatives, this is not a liberal book. It's also not a conservative book. We really believe that, Steve, you didn't get here by accident, and I didn't get here by accident. We both got to where we are thanks to the greatest public-private partnership in the history of the world. Where we are at our best is when we combine government at the right size and role, creating this enabling infrastructure, and then standing back and letting the private sector, with its initiative and energy, take it as far as it can. And where we get out of balance is when one smothers the other. Either the private smothers the public, hello, 2008 subprime crisis, or the public smothers the private, at different times, you know, especially in cities now where governments have gotten so large and taken on such pension obligations that you can't actually build the infrastructure anymore.
Okay, so how do we get out of this then?
You know, our whole point is We got here thanks to a formula for success that we built up over many years. We got out of here because we got away from that formula. We only get back here when we get back to that formula. You know, everyone's looking for some razzmatazz, you know, kind of quick fix. It's about education, infrastructure, immigration, the right rules to incentivize risk-taking and prevent recklessness, and government-funded research. And so there is no quick fix. We didn't get in here the long way. We're not going to get out of here the long way. And that's why we have been arguing that, you know, we basically have a choice as a country now. We can have a hard decade or a bad century. That is, we can actually take this decade, stand back, roll up our sleeves, get back to doing what made us great, all right, or we're going to have a bad century. We're going to limp into the 21st century.
Okay, so you're saying that we have to take our medicine and kind of grit it out for a while. What is the medicine here?
Well, the medicine is first of all, it starts with education. And it's not just about, you know, rebuilding the worst schools in the country. It's about collective action. It's about collaborative efforts basically to attract the best teachers to public education, to incentivize people to go in that direction, and to also, with teachers, work out systems to enable and enrich the best teachers and weed out the worst. That's the first thing.
Okay, so just break this down for a moment. So
please
pay teachers more, at least the good teachers, and have some capacity to get rid of the bad teachers.
Yep, number one. But that's just the first part of the education challenge, because we believe that we cannot do to America's teachers what we did to America's soldiers, which is outsource the whole problem to them. We kind of outsourced the war on terrorism, you know, to one half of 1% who went off to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. The rest of us went on our way. We believe the education problem in this country is a collective problem. Yes, we need better teachers. My wife's a school teacher. My daughter's a school teacher. So I'm a little sensitive on this issue. We need better teachers. But you know what we also need, Steve? We need better parents. Parents more involved every day in their kids' education. We also need better neighbors, neighbors who care about their public schools, whether they have kids in them or not. We need better politicians, politicians who make clear that your kid is not just competing against a school down the street, but he's now competing against the kids at PS21 in Shanghai. We need better business leaders who care about the schools in our country and don't just say, well, if I can't get the workers here, I'll just outsource it somewhere else. And lastly, we need better students, students who come to school ready to learn, not just to text. Okay? So this is a collective action problem, education. And it isn't just going to come by blaming and fixating on teachers. We all need to roll up our sleeves.
What's the evidence that our students really are falling behind, that our standards of education are not as good as some of the other countries out there?
Well, if you take the PISA test, which is the best kind of international comparative test on both writing, math, and science for 15-year-olds, we're right there in the middle of the pack with Slovenia. We are not leaders in these math and science competitions or in the writing competitions. We quote the latest sort of statistic from – there's an annual kind of, you know, math genius competition for college students. And I think we had one school in the top 10 in Michigan. And you know, you look at any international comparison test and we're now in the middle of the pack. And a lot of people say, well, that's because we have more diverse population. No, they factor in all of that, okay? I'm tired of having to explain like why we're in the middle of the pack. How about we just come out number one and not have to explain anything anymore?
So I want to follow up on this question of math and science education and the implication for jobs, because, of course, jobs is the mantra for every national politician these days, that we need more jobs. Are you saying that's the ticket to create more jobs in this country, is this basic knowledge in technology and science literacy?
No, I think it's one ticket for one part of the population. And it's great. God, you wish everyone could be like, you know, the late great Steve Jobs. But they can't. But everyone can do something. Everyone's got some extra in them. You know, how many of us – I'm 58. You know, I've been through, you know, mother in a nursing home. How many of us would pay extra for that one nursing home employee who engaged our elderly parent and didn't just, you know, feed them and do their job, but actually brought a smile on their face every day? And so what we argue in the book is everyone's got to think about their extra. And a very helpful way to do it is think of yourself today. Think of the way you approach your job in two ways. One, the way a new immigrant would approach their job, and the other, the way an artisan would approach their job. What do I mean? So what does a new immigrant say to a country? He or she says, you know what? There's no legacy place waiting for me here at the University of Wisconsin, okay, or at Harvard. I better earn whatever I am going to eat. And that means I better understand what's going on in this society, where the opportunities are, and outwork, all right, everybody else. That's how the new immigrant leans into the world. Well, we are all new immigrants today into the hyper-connected world. That's number one. And number two, think like an artisan. This is an idea we got from Lawrence Katz up at Harvard. You know, Larry says basically that everyone's got to be an artisan today. Who is the artisan? The artisan was that person in the Middle Ages before mass manufacturing who made every item individually. Every purse, every wallet, every saddle, every pair of shoes, every utensil, every tool, they made individually. They brought their special passion to it. And the best artisans were so proud of their work, they carved their initials into it. Well, I say do your job every day as if you would want to carve your initials into it at the end of the day. Because every employer now is saying to himself, I only want to hire someone if I have to. Because everyone today has to be a unique value creator. Because if they're not, you know, I'm not going to be able to stay in business. And that is a new work challenge. I'm an old fuddy-duddy. I'm 58. I had the pleasure of finding a job when I graduated from college. I'm very aware that my kids will increasingly have to invent a job. We got to find jobs. They will have to invent jobs.
Now, there's another way to look at some of these issues. Maybe it's time for the United States to give up its role as the lone superpower, the global policeman. And I guess I'm wondering if America would be better off if it just tried to get its own house in order. I mean, for instance, imagine if we weren't paying for these very expensive wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Should our country just pull back?
Well, you know, it's a good question. And in general, I would say no. Think about this. When Britain went into decline, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, America was right there to pick up the kind of leadership role. What is that leadership role, I mean, today? It's really being the balancer, the stabilizer of the global system. We make all kinds of mistakes and we are hardly perfect. But I think we do a lot more good than bad in the world, okay? Whether it's the AIDS programs we fund in Africa or whether it's the sea lanes we keep open in the Asia Pacific that benefit us and benefit the world. And so we really believe that America is the tentpole that holds up the world. And you see that tentpole buckle or fray, your kids won't just grow up in a different America. They'll grow up in a different world because there is no benign superpower to pick up the role from us. Would you like a world ordered by China? I wouldn't. Would you like a world ordered by Putin, czar president for life, forever? I wouldn't. So this is a core argument of the book. It's why we feel it's so important that America, you know, get its groove back, because it won't just be a different America. It'll be a different world.
Thomas Friedman is the foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. He's the author of That Used to Be Us. Steve Paulson spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1023A, How to Fail. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Sarah Nix, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.